United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against McElwain. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Shay Stanford, and together with Colonel Christopher O'Brien, we represent the appellant in this case, Specialist Kevin L. McElwain. The military judge in a trial before court-martial members erred in denying a motion for recusal after stating that while she could remain impartial in a trial before members, she would recuse herself if she were the military judge, if she were the trier of fact. This court should apply the plain language of RCM 902 and follow the clear, simple, straightforward rule set forth in Parentel P. Jacobson to find a military judge cannot partially recuse herself where a judge has any doubt as to her ability to preside impartially or whenever she believes her impartiality might reasonably be questioned. She is required to allow a motion for recusal. Her failure to do so creates substantial doubt as to the fairness of the court-martial. Rule for court-martial 902 on its face does not allow the judge an option for recusal or to continue sitting with the panel. It requires the judge to recuse herself in any proceeding where the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned. In this case, the military judge herself made a decision that she would not sit if she were the finder of fact. This came not in response to a request for a military judge, her own request. The judge herself seemed to apply the subjective analysis set forth in Parenteau.
Do we know, or are you arguing that the judge did that with a specific reference to one of the 902 categories? What can you point to in the record that indicates that this judge felt she was disqualified based on a particular express requirement from 902 versus a prudential consideration or for some other reason?
Well, she never states the rule for court-martial or her what rule would disqualify her. She merely states that she would recuse herself initially in the record at starting.
So is it possible then to read the record? You don't have to concede it. I'm just asking, is it within the realm of the possible to read the record as an exercise in prudence as opposed to an exercise in requirement?
I don't think so in this case, Your Honor, because she goes on to say, after the appellant did object, she goes on to say that she had made decisions that would suggest to an impartial person that she could not remain impartial.
Can you please read to me or cite to me the specific language so I have no doubt how you wish to frame your argument when we're debating it?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'll accept page numbers as well.
At page 20, Your Honor, of the record of trial, she is basically states again that if the panel wants to go judge alone, she would not be comfortable sitting. She says she's made decisions, frankly, probably favorable to you in terms of credibility of witnesses, but nevertheless, decisions that would suggest to an impartial person looking in that I can't be impartial in the case.
So you think that's the strongest language from the judge supporting your position, and that's what you would hope we would focus on?
Well, I think that is clearly a disqualifying factor under 902A, but it's also not clear based on the timing if she herself subjectively just felt that she couldn't remain impartial in the case. Because as I mentioned, starting at page 16, she goes into her reasons before form is selected.
But what about the language on page 20 when she says, I'm absolutely convinced that I can do that impartially, fairly, and in accordance with constitutional standards, talking about the role she's actually going to play in the case?
Yes, Your Honor, and she does state that she's subjectively confident that she can remain impartial as if she is not the finder of fact. She does state that. However, that also implies that she's not subjectively confident that she can do that as the finder of fact. The rules don't allow her to make that distinction. Once disqualified, she's disqualified from sitting, even if it's a panel case.
What about the language in Sheridan? It seems to open that door. How do you deal with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You know what I'm referring to.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. This case is a lot like the case of Sherrod or Sherrod. And the court held that when a trial judge is disqualified, all actions from that point on are void, except those immediately necessary to assure the swift and orderly substitution of judges. It goes on to say if a judge is disqualified to sit as judge alone, she's also disqualified.
Right, but I'm drawing your attention to the next paragraph. It says, next, there inevitably will be a class of cases comprising that middle ground where the judge has been judicially exposed to information, such as during a providence inquiry or related trial of a co-accused, but where the judge is not otherwise disqualified. In those cases, within his or her sound discretion, the judge may well decline to sit alone, and we see little basis for substituting our judgment for the judge's. This class of cases, therefore, is different from those in which a judge is disqualified from sitting.
Yes, sir.
So my question is, can you please address that language and why you don't should not fall within it?
Well, the judge was specifically asked by appellant on page 17, do you feel that the testimony you heard in the other cases in any way will affect the manner in which you rule in this case as far as Specialist McElwain? And her answer wasn't, if it was, as you're saying, she had no doubts as to her ability to preside. She could have merely said, yes, I can set aside those things and I can be fair and impartial. But she doesn't say that. She says she's heard a lot about Specialist McElwain and that she would recuse herself if it was a judge-alone case. So I think that takes us out of the realm to where, within her sound discretion, she can decide not to sit, but it brings us into the place where she is disqualified, and therefore she would have done nothing other than getting another judge. And she even says on the record, on page 18, that she would recess the court and get another judge to sit. So there was no exigent circumstances or anything on the record, at least.
So you're satisfied with the framework suggested and presented in Sheridan?
Yes, sir.
You're just saying you fit into it here, not here.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Are you, would recusal have been indicated in this case if the judge hadn't made the statement to the effect that she couldn't sit this way, but she could sit that way? On these facts, without that assertion by the judge, would recusal have been indicated?
No, Your Honor. Not if the judge herself was convinced in her own mind that she could remain impartial. Military judge.
Well, I'm not looking to the judge's mind. I'm just saying if the judge had not said on the record,
yes,
I can't sit judge alone, but I can sit members.
Yes, Your Honor. If there had been a motion for recusal just based on the fact she had sat on the related cases, that would not be a basis for disqualification. But certainly when a motion for recusal is made, the judge has a duty to put facts on the record and give her reasons why a recusal is not granted.
Counsel, you mentioned that she said that she had ruled favorably on matters that would be favorable towards the accused. It's not clear from the record whether it was in this case or in other cases. Is a judge required to recuse herself on motion of a party if there's an indication that she's favorable towards that party?
Yes, Your Honor. Anytime she is going to be favorable to either party, she should recuse herself.
And why is that?
Well, the rule specifically states any party, and reasonably any person who thinks they can be are favorable towards one side perhaps might overcompensate towards another side and end up doing what they don't expect to do, which would be somewhat burdensome on the appellant in the case. That's why neutrality is so important with our military judges. The test in Sherrod is a simple and straightforward test, basically asking the judge to first apply a subjective test to determine whether she's comfortable sitting. And then only if she passes that test, she is to attempt the objective test as to whether an impartial person would find she couldn't be partial in the case. The judge in this case seemed to fail both tests and therefore created a substantial doubt as to her ability to sit fairly. For even if a member of the public, if this court found that the trial was overall fair, even in spite of her comments, it would certainly be hard to convince a member of the public that a disqualified judge could sit, even with a trial before members, and preside fairly. This case raises substantial doubt as to the appearance of partiality in this case.
Would, since appellant ended up being tried by members, didn't that insulate him from any prejudice?
No, I think that certainly the courts have suggested that that's a possibility and would be in some cases. If the court were to look back on a judge's decision not to recuse herself under other circumstances where she was comfortable sitting and didn't find that there was a problem with a reasonable person looking in, I think, and you found later that she was mistaken, then perhaps the panel could have insulated it. But I think the court in Sherrod well pointed out that a panel is not an insulating factor when you have a disqualified judge. And that's the difference in this case. The judge was disqualified both by her statement that she would recuse herself and also by her statement that an impartial person, as she put it, would think she couldn't be partial in this case. And as the Army Court pointed out when they were determining disqualification in Sherrod, that statement in open court seriously compromises any other determination later. Because 902A is concerned primarily with the appearance of impartiality.
Can you point to any ruling or decision by the military judge in this case that prejudiced your client?
Your Honor, the decision that prejudiced the client was her decision not to allow recusal.
I'm not asking you about that decision. I'm asking you about in the course of the actual court-martial. Can you point to anything that the military judge in this case did that prejudiced your client?
No, Your Honor. All it did was raise the appearance every time she did rule.
Can I ask the question a different way? Yes. Can you point to any ruling in the case from the judge which was in part based on the credibility of the witnesses?
Well, there were two witnesses that testified in the case. Three witnesses that were also witnesses in the other cases. And there were objections. Now, as I mentioned, I cannot say that she abused her discretion in any way, but it certainly does raise...
Who were the three witnesses, please, and what did they say?
It would be Specialist Lowe. It would be Specialist Williams and the victim, Ms. Gerstacker. Specialist Lowe and Williams are both co-accused in the case, so their testimony was basically what they saw and what their involvement in the case was. They were both obviously previously tried and convicted at that point.
And did the judge make any rulings on what was admitted or not admitted during their testimony?
Your Honor, I don't have that handy right now. There was nothing that, I understand your question, okay. But there was nothing to draw my attention to any objection where the judge was not within her discretion within those rulings. And I didn't mention before, the accused also did take the stand. And again, there's nothing that was improper about her questions. And I did mention in my brief that the court members had questions as well. There was nothing inappropriate in the way that she would decipher their questions and ask for the panel members. However, every time she is more actively making decisions in the case, it certainly raises the appearance of bias because we just don't know what impact that had on her decisions.
How many questions did the members ask?
On page 15 of your brief.
Six questions approximately posed by the members, and she interpreted them to, they became 76 questions.
76 questions by the judge.
Yes,
and ma'am. With respect to objections, again, if you could take a look during your opportunity to prepare for a rebuttal in response to Judge Baker's question, whether there are any objections to testimony by witnesses, any witnesses in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And could you also look at the 26 questions that were that grew in magnitude when translated by a military judge and see if you can determine whether they grew because they were compounded in the first instance or whether it was for some other reason?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you want us to give the government more time during their argument? The government will have 4 hours to argue.
I think we're going to keep this within 20 minutes if we can.
I will take a look at those things and, on rebuttal, try to answer them.
Yeah, and in fairness, as Judge Baker suggested, if the opportunity to pay attention to the government's argument and prepare yourself for rebuttal is inadequate, just let us know.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, to sum up, the military judge's statements, both that she would recuse herself if she was a trier of fact, disqualified her. She was not, at that point, at liberty to find out whether appellant wanted a panel and preside. She was disqualified to sit, and this court should determine that that is enough and to create the appearance, at least, of impartiality and question the fairness of the entire court-martial.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Nicole Fish, and I, along with Major Elizabeth Murata, represent the United States in this matter. The standard of review is abuse of discretion, which occurs when a judge erroneously applies the law and clearly errs in making his or her findings of fact. Abuse of discretion recognizes that the military judge has a range of choices and that they will not reverse so long as that decision remains within that range. Today, I intend to discuss two reasons why the military judge stayed within that range and did not abuse her discretion in not recusing herself in appellant's case. First, there's no evidence of the military judge being disqualified under the enumerated grounds of recusal under 902A, or 902B, sorry. Second, the facts and circumstances satisfy 902A under the Campos test. And assuming arguendo that the military judge did err in failing to recuse herself, the case should be affirmed based on the harmless error test in United States versus Wilkins. First, appellant's allegations of actual bias do not fit any of the five enumerated grounds requiring judicial disqualification because there are none. She learned of her information in her judicial capacity and said on the record that she had made no decisions or findings or opinions as to appellant's guilt or innocence. Second, the military judge satisfies 902A under the Campos test, which requires three things. First, it requires disclosure and disclaim of any impact. Two, it requires the opportunity to voir dire by the parties, as well as to present evidence. And third, that there was no prejudice on the appellant. In this
that, case, in Campos, is that a test for recusal or is that a test for prejudice? I mean, does Campos stand for the proposition that any time that a judge announces at trial that I have a bias in a particular fashion, and here it is, and I dare you to make a recusal motion, that's sufficient? That's somewhat of an argumentative question, but that appears to be what the government is suggesting that Campos stands for.
Your Honor, if I understand your question, the military judge has an obligation under 902A for the objective part to determine whether, you know, impartiality is reasonably questioned. Now, once that decision is made, it is reviewed abuse of discretion, and at the appellate level, we then look to Campos to determine whether or not that military judge did abuse her discretion.
Does Campos stand for the proposition that disclosure is sufficient?
Disclosure is one part. It requires more than just disclosure. Disclosure plus disclaiming any impact that, in this case, it was disclosing that she had heard two companion cases. And then she disclaimed that there was any impact of those companion cases on her in making the decision.
If that takes place, I'm not sure what that has to do with recusal. That is, the judge is announcing there, I'm not recusing myself. So either that's correct or it's incorrect. I don't see how the disclosure helps the situation at all, or that Campos has anything to say other than we assess for prejudice. That is, if a judge makes that announcement and on review it's determined that the grounds which she has announced should have required disclosure, the fact that she disclosed it and said, I don't think I'm recused, that wouldn't help her at all, would it?
I'm a little confused. Sorry.
Can a judge announce reasons for not recusing? And if those reasons, in fact, are incorrect, that is, she should have recused herself, does the announcement of the reasons and her statement that she thinks that she is not disqualified, does that disclosure to the parties cure any error with respect to her failure to recuse if the parties don't object?
If a military judge is required to recuse themselves and they were disqualified, then it does not matter that they disclosed any of the other factors of Campos. The issue here in this case was that she was not disqualified under 902A at the trial level. If we look at the timing of the action, she actually brought up the fact that she had heard these companion cases. She then said that she had made no decision on findings or opinions as to the guilt or innocence of the appellant. She then allowed them to ask questions to ensure that she had not had any issues with these companion cases, but gave the opportunity to appellant to ensure that he wanted, whether he wanted a judge-alone case or a panel case in this matter. He had already predated on 8 January that he wanted a trial by numbers, but she was giving him the opportunity again before the forum choice to make that decision.
Well, hasn't the defense conceded that? They've conceded, as I understand it, that she's not disqualified under 902B. This is a 902A case, isn't it? Is it not?
It is, Your Honor.
So where does that get us?
It gets you to where the timing is of that statement. She had already, at that point, gone through the objection for her staying in this case was so that she had heard these companion cases, and that's what made her appear to look impartial. She, in her discretion, was choosing to not sit alone in this case. As in Sherrod, they discussed those.
Why isn't Sherrod dispositive?
I'm sorry?
Why isn't Sherrod dispositive on the question of partial recusal?
In this case, it's not dispositive of partial recusal because she didn't recuse herself in the sense of she was disqualified. She recused herself, decided to not sit judge alone as a matter of discretion because she had heard these companion cases. And that is why she gave the opportunity to appellant to choose if you did want judge alone.
Well, I mean, in a sense, okay, isn't that ephemeral? I mean, she didn't actually recuse herself at all. He never elected to go judge alone, so she wasn't recusing herself. She was perhaps talking too much on the record, and out of an abundance of caution and prudence, she was disclosing the fact that as they existed. But she never recused herself based on the fact that it was military judge alone, because this was never a military judge alone trial.
Yes, Your Honor. She went through the process of determining whether or not, in ensuring that the forum choice was trial by members prior to making any decision whatsoever. Once he chose trial by members, the objection was still there, and she said, because your basis is based on having heard these companion cases, that it creates an impartiality, and looking at impartiality is a question, that your recusal is denied.
Well, can you turn to the language, the rollover language on 1920, and in light of the appellant's earlier argument focusing on that language, why doesn't that create an appearance issue?
In that part, starting on 19, paragraph just above.
Right. Specifically, line 22, as I said, if you wanted to go with a judge, which is a qualification, but then it moves on and says, nevertheless, decisions that would suggest to an impartial person looking in that I can't be impartial in this case. And why isn't that more than an abundance of caution and move into the area of an actual appearance of impartiality? Or partiality, or whatever the opposite of what we're wanting is.
Your Honor, I believe, too, if you look right above that is where she denied the request, and then she goes into, you know, if you want, I want to go to judge alone, because I feel. It appears at this point that she's already made that decision. The I feel is her personal, subjective opinion, which, although not irrelevant, is not case dispositive. So we go to weighing.
But whatever she feels, she nevertheless believes the decisions that she has made would suggest to an impartial person looking in that I can't be impartial in this case. How do you address that language?
Again, it looks, I mean, it's very obviously very analogous to 902A in the wording that's in 902A. However, the way it falls with the timing of the actual recusal decision, that appears to be her personal opinion, not her judicial decision on the recusal. So she's not disqualifying herself based on that statement.
Okay, well, let's look at the language of 902, and let's look at the proceeding that we actually had here and focus on the language and ask the question, which apparently I would assume we get to decide, irrespective of what she thought, which is, in this proceeding, as it actually took place, would the military judge's impartiality reasonably be questioned? So why don't you address that issue? In this proceeding, where he had given a notice of quorum and the members were sitting outside the courtroom and it was going to be a member's trial, and a military judge said, I sat in two companion cases, and if I was sitting as a military judge alone in this case, I think that my impartiality could be questioned, but I'm not. Would a reasonable member of the public question her impartiality in the role that she actually played?
Your Honor, again, that was in the personal opinion. It's not looked from the opinion of the judge or from the appellant's perspective. It's looked from the reasonable person standard.
Right.
So a reasonable person looking in is going to see that this military judge, the decision burden with the fact finder and the sentencing determination, if he was found guilty, would be the panel and would no longer...
Reasonable person or reasonable lawyer? Is the average man standing outside John Pugh Public in the street going to draw a distinction between the trier of fact and the trier of law?
I think, Your Honor, that they see the difference when there's a jury, you know, out or a panel case. They see that they are making a decision. Now, the judge has the ability to make decisions on evidence and other items like that. But in this case, as has been seen, this judge, there was nothing in the record that supports that she in any way imposed any bias towards this case.
Well, no, now you're going to actual bias again. I'm talking about appearances. I'm talking about the question Judge Ryan asked, which is, would a reasonable person looking at this trial presided over by a judge who has said on the record that she could not sit in a judge-alone trial, would the reasonable person perceive that trial to be fair and impartial?
I do not think that a reasonable person would, because I think a reasonable person looking in still sees, you know, a panel or a jury, that they are making that decision. And I think they would be able to differentiate, at least from their perspective, that there is a difference and that panel versus a judge alone would have a different effect.
Is there any case law to support that proposition?
In United States versus Oakley, it's a very similar case to this, where she had heard companion cases, or he had heard companion cases. And the information came up during those trials as well. And he said, similar to what she said, I made no determination concerning guilt or innocence. Asked if they wanted a further voir dire, which she said they did the same thing here. They continued to move for recusal under 902A. And he denied that request. Now,
did Oakley involve a statement on the record that I couldn't be impartial in a judge alone case?
No, Your Honor. I've not found a case with that specific statement.
Thank you.
Counsel, at the outset of the case, this is a case involving rape and sodomy. And with respect to what a judge might be expected to rule on that case when there are 403 evidentiary issues, or when we're dealing with the character of the alleged victim, you have 412 issues. What do you do in a situation like that where the judge is required to make fact-intensive determinations that involve evaluating the evidence in the case and the testimony of witnesses. Why isn't that sufficient to call into question whether someone can impartially sit in a case when they may be called upon to make those decisions? I'm putting aside the question of whether that actually took place in the case, but that would go to prejudice. At the outset, when you're asked to decide, if the judge is asked to decide whether he or she can sit on the case and expresses concern about impartiality on facts, why shouldn't we take into account the type of fact-based decisions that judges have to make in trials?
Your Honor, you do take into consideration that they do have to make these decisions, but opinions that are formed in prior proceedings, like in the companion cases in this matter, do not constitute the basis for recusal unless those opinions have displayed that they have favoritism or an antagonism towards making a fair judgment in another case, because each case has its own evidence.
Well, I don't perceive that there's any difference between the government and the defense on that issue. Is there? That is, that the defense has agreed that whatever exposure the judge has had in prior cases does not provide a basis for disqualification.
I mean, it seems to me that the problem here is that the military judge never says that she can't be impartial. She suggested that the fact that she was exposed to other cases might suggest to an outside observer that she can't be impartial. Well, as far as I understand the case law of this court, that's not the rule. It's never been the rule in this court that someone is disqualified under 902A because they have sat on companion cases. And so she's making an observation that is not, in fact, the law, and it has nothing to do whether she can actually be impartial or not.
She in no way made any further commentary. She was being, in abundance of caution, she was saying additional comments that were not necessary. In relation to Campos, the prejudice argument, determining, based on the entire record, the appellant was not prejudiced in this case because there was no actual reasons, grounds for refusal, no personal relationships, no bias or animus towards any parties. The information that she did obtain was in the judicial capacity. The fact finder and the sentence were determined by the panel. The evidence supports the finding of the sentence, and the record shows fairness, that the military judge was fair and proper in her objections, asking the questions of the panel members, and that there was no objections on instructions or findings or sentence. Then the military judge did use her discretion. She talked about sitting, she would not sit alone in this case, and that is one factor as well. We take all the facts and circumstances, and it is found that an appellant was not prejudiced. Therefore, the military judge in this case did not abuse her discretion. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? This court should find that the military judge did not abuse her discretion because the military judge's impartiality could not reasonably be questioned based on all of the relevant facts and circumstances of this case. And even if it is found that the judge did err in this case, the error was harmless under U.S. v. Wilchmark.
Thank you, counsel. Normally I'd ask if defense has any rebuttal, but I guess defense had a little homework assignment here, so we'll give the opportunity for
yes,
defense.
Yes, sir, and if I may first address the rebuttal and then try to answer your questions. It's been mentioned here that perhaps the judge, just at the limits of caution, decided not to sit as the military judge alone in this case. However, judges are presumed to know the law, and the law, as Judge Ryan said, is clear that sitting on related cases are not going to necessarily require her to accuse herself.
Okay, well, let's be clear, she didn't decide not to sit as a judge alone. She was never asked to sit as judge alone,
That's correct. That is correct. And she was saying that to allow the appellant the information just in case he wanted to. However, at that point, when they still objected, she had a duty to put facts on the record that doesn't raise at least the appearance of impartiality, which is substantial in this case. Oakley was mentioned and as a similar case, but it really isn't similar in that the military judge assured the accused in that case that he would listen to the evidence presented at that trial and use that as the only basis for his decision. In McElwain, they asked a specific question: will anything you heard affect your rulings in this case? They didn't parse out whether you're a judge alone or whether you're a panel. She didn't answer that question as, no, I'm going to listen to your case as if for the first time. She said, I heard a lot about appellants, and I would recuse myself if I was the finder of facts. And understanding the law in this case, and presuming that the military judge knows the law, would seem to say that she was personally not satisfied she could sit. However, it certainly did raise the appearance of impropriety, or appearance of impartiality in the case.
What about on page 16 when she said, at any rate, I made no decision or findings or opinion as to your guilt or innocence because, of course, we have not heard any evidence in your case and are prepared to do so here today. The problem that I'm having, counsel, is that I don't understand how we decide this case the way that you would like us to without finding that, in fact, there is an appearance of bias and an appearance of impartiality, of a partiality under 902A whenever someone is sat on a companion case.
I don't think the court has to do that to reverse this conviction. Judges, in case law and my research, judges are clear. When a motion for recusal is sought, they have to put facts on the record, such as Oakley, that they're confident in their ability to preside. If it's based on a previous related case, then they have assured the court that they can put aside what they've heard and view the case on its merits. That would solve the problem. This is an unusual case here, and certainly we're not going to second-guess a judge who may have decided that she simply had doubts as to her ability to remain impartial in this case.
Did you want to address the question?
Yes, Your Honor. I will try to answer your questions. There were 12 defense objections, 6 were sustained, 6 were overruled. The witnesses were the witnesses that I mentioned from the previous court martial. There were, the defense counsel objected to 3 questions by panel members, and the military judge sustained that and rephrased the question. Trial counsel had 6 objections, 3 were overruled, 3 were sustained. The government points out that 6 and 6 and 3 and 3 means fairness. That's not necessarily the case. And my only point in this is I can't say that anything she did was not within her discretion, is that everything she did after she put those facts initially raised the appearance of impartiality. And certainly a member of the public who is not trained in the law would misunderstand and wonder whether or not those decisions she made had any effect, or whether any of her bias had crept into those decisions. That's the only point that I would make there.
And of the 12 and of the 6, are any of them, in your view, require the judge to make credibility determinations in order to rule on the objection?
Not that I recall from the objections, Your Honor. I can't point specifically to anything that she, I don't believe that she used any previous knowledge in the case in ruling on those. But again, I'm not sure. When a discretionary decision is made, oftentimes, you know, you can call upon the government to have a response and things like that. So we just don't know what effect it would have.
Thank you.
That answers your question.
It does answer my question.
What about the members?
Thank you for your candor there as well.
Did you have an opportunity to look at the members' questions to determine whether they proliferated because they were compound or multifaceted or for some other reason?
Yes, Your Honor. Many of them were compound. And again, I can't say that the military judge went beyond her scope of what she had heard in that court-martial, and certainly was within her duty as a presiding judge to expand on those questions. But again, that's the risk that we take with having a disqualified judge sit in a trial before members. And again, the disqualification rules are very clear. They don't allow the judge the option. And the reason is she's disqualified. Once disqualified, if she's allowed to preside even with members, then disqualification doesn't really mean anything. And a member of the public certainly would question whether a disqualified judge could remain fair and impartial. For those reasons, we ask that you set aside the findings of guilty.
Thank you, counsel. We've provided the defense with a bit extra time. Was there anything that the government would want to say in response to those particular matters discussed at the end? Thank you. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10 minutes before 10 o'clock.
Court stands in recess until 9:45.